Francis Bacon, in his system called the Pyramid of Pan, to examine the sources of essential knowledge, had as the first source of learning tradition. Tradition covers the entire period of recorded knowledge from the beginning to whatever may become the modern level. It will go on into the future, and much that we are doing now will add to the substance of tradition. Now, tradition is of importance to us in many ways, and I think Lord Bacon, being a devoutly religious man, was one of the first to recognize that tradition is more than the continuance of the record of mistakes. Tradition is a source of knowledge concerning the workings of universal law in the lives of individuals and collective groups. We have no direct way of tuning in on the infinite program in the ordinary knowledge of science. We are not able to be sure that we understand any part of that mystery which is beyond the comprehension of our sensory perceptions. We do know, however, that we have a kind of collective memory called tradition, which tells us a lot of things about the operations of the divine plan, even though we may not be able to classify them completely. If we want to know how man should live, we can only examine how man has lived, what he has done right and what he has done wrong. We can only base modern concepts of integrity upon the evidences of the past. And these evidences are usually rather clear, rather simple, and largely unacceptable. We do not like to admit that anywhere in the universe there is anything that can prevent us from doing exactly as we please. Now, if we do exactly as we please long enough, we only have to refer to tradition to find out what happens to people who do exactly as they please. We not only have the problem of the past, but we have the daily newspaper. We have all kinds of records of what happens to people who do certain things. If we find consistently that those people who do those things come to those ends, inevitably, we seem to get a touch of understanding of the operation of the moral universe. Now, apparently in the moral universe, the study of sin at its largest foundation. Sin was perhaps a word derived from the name of an old Chaldean moon god, but it has long passed out of the theological structure of that kind. Sin to the modern religionist is an evil against spirit. It is some transaction affecting the internal life of the individual, and crime is that type of misdemeanor which affects the physical life of the individual. All material things can be termed basically in terms of crime and compensation, but metaphysical things become matters of sin and honesty. Now, when we go back over the problems of sin and to see why some of them are unforgivable and others seemingly are forgivable, we become more and more aware that the basic integrities of life are uncorruptible. They cannot be broken down. They cannot be replaced. They cannot be ignored. But there is a vast structure of secondary factors that can in one way be adjusted, changed, modified, or reacted upon. So for all intent and purposes, what Bacon called tradition presents us with a large pattern of a large group of great laws operating continuously throughout time and eternity. Now, what we have to understand first, perhaps, is that to a great degree we associate these laws with the divine purpose. In other words, the divine laws are the manifestation of divinity. Divinity itself is a word, standing for an immense, incredible moral causation, for which there is no exception. We find that what we call divinity, therefore, is intangible, rather reticent in appearing, but constantly operating. And against the operations of this vast divine complex of things, there can be no escape, no evasion, and no course of avoidance. The operations of natural law, particularly as these refer to the inner life of the individual, are inflexible. Now, if we want to study this a little bit, we can take, for example, some thought that we all have or have had at one time or another. One could be fame, and another could be wealth. Now, we can trace both of these terms back to prehistoric times and see what happens in connection with them. Well, we can start with someone like fame, and we can start in with a very early expression of this fame. Well, we'll take Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great had his idea of conquering the world. He began to be very unhappy at the thought there would be no worlds to conquer by the time he got through. So, with this great plan in mind, Alexander died in his 30s at the foot of the city walls of Babylon, cut down by what? Dissipation. There was the end of this great one who just knew everything but did not know enough to keep sober. Now we go along a little ways further in this great pattern of effects and so forth, and we come on Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar, according to the speech of Antony, was an honorable man. He was a warrior, a statesman, and gradually came to be the moving power behind a great institutional system and structure, the Roman Empire. And in the midst of all his glory, he was stabbed to death by his best friend and died at the foot of Pompey's column for the Ides of March. He was the great man, but all of a sudden he wasn't there anymore. All of the things he had planned, nothing happened. He was gone. Another interesting and rather powerful character song along this way was Genghis Khan, the great Mongol conqueror. He was determined to conquer everything. He was called himself the Son of God. He started forth, and where did he end? He ended on the outskirts of Europe, tied with ropes to his horse so his people wouldn't know he was dead. That was the end of that great escapade. Now along comes another little man, physically little as well as every other way, and that is Napoleon Bonaparte. He was a real busy world conqueror, and he felt empowered by God to do this. It was a great project. He admitted, however, that it was easier to conquer than govern. He admitted that. Also, he admitted that he couldn't hold anybody he conquered unless they had a religion. But anyway, he went on his way, and in due time ended his life on the island of St. Helena. All the dream gone, dissipation gone, and very possibly poisoned by his own doctor. Then along comes another little man who thought he was going to be able to do great and wonderful things, Adolf Hitler. The story of him is rather well known, but because the traditional factor is no longer emphasized in education, an examination in the public school system showed that half the pupils did not know who Hitler was. That is the great memory of the great man, forgotten before he's hardly cold, and Hitler finally dead in a bunker in Berlin. And his friend and fellow dictator, Adolf Hitler, not doing much, Benito Mussolini, not doing much better, also died assassinated or killed to get rid of him. So all these people together should have something to say about would-be empire builders. Something in nature says no. And everyone thinks they can be an exception to that no. But up to the present time, there has been no exception. The way of peace is the way of survival. The way of war is the way of death. This has been proven since the very dawn of time. Some power beyond our own works out these things in patterns that seem suitable to our needs. Another one of our great fetishes is wealth. And wealth at the present time is very closely interwoven with conquest. War and wealth kind of tie together now. In ancient times, they were not quite so closely related. But wealth was a very interesting thing. And one of the great rulers, the tyrants of Greece, Croesus, had the so-called traditional wealth of the ages, the richest man who ever lived. He brought in a philosopher one day to look over his treasury. The philosopher looked back quietly and said, "Croesus, you have a wonderful treasury in gold, but the first man with better iron will take it away from you." And that was what happened. All the way along, false values fail. And yet, strange as it may seem, false values seem to be the most attractive. No one considers a mediocre career to be as attractive as a few years of despotism. Mussolini himself said he'd rather be a lion for a few years than a lamb for a lifetime. He got his wish. Now, Bacon, looking back over this situation, comes to the conclusion that there are rules, and that when we start to do something, we are going to be faced by every bit of experience that has descended from the past. We are going to be faced with the problems of government. Government is another big one. And we begin to see what doesn't work and what does work. And if it doesn't work, we keep on trying. And generation after generation and civilization after civilization, we subject to exactly the same mistakes. We also have an idea that power is a reward for something. More likely, it is a penalty. Now, on the life level of average persons, our old friend Bacon tells us, or shows us, the lives of private citizens on this mysterious pyramid of Pan that ascends from earth to sky. The average citizen is, after all, the most fortunate of all creatures. He is not subject to the vast ambitions that end in annihilation. He is not subject to the great financial ambitions that lead him in the end to misery and death. And as a moderate person, he has great opportunities to do well in this life. But we begin to look over this individual, and we find that time has been working quite a hardship on the concept. The individual today has no interest in being simply comfortable. His great desire is to excel and exceed. In science, mathematics, astronomy, and music were the sciences of antiquity. While we worked with them, they didn't do us any great amount of harm. In fact, they did considerable good. They helped us to develop our knowledge of the solar system. They helped to give us magnificent music and harmonies, and they helped to give us a deeper understanding of the world in which we live. They helped us to add up the grocery bill and things of that nature. But now, all of a sudden, all of these subjects have loomed into vastness. They have become worlds in themselves. And these worlds are simply too small for people to live in without being constantly miserable. You can take the great world of science. It's a world so attractive, so remarkable, so wonderful, that most all young people want to get into it as soon as they can, because they'd like to explore the idea of what is in space. They want to be on the first shuttle to Mars. It's all very good, but science has also handed us something we don't know what to do with even yet, the computer. Now, it's becoming more and more obvious that unless there is discipline in the productivity of science, if everyone invents everything he can think of, there's going to be a lot of trouble in this world, because these things each has a consequence. And Bacon points out that when you make a plan to develop something, you always want to make a plan that includes a number of years of what's going to happen after you develop it. Because here we have a computer that at the present time is going forward at such a rate of speed that it is liable to take up practically every aspect of human life. First thing you know, they won't go to school anymore. Well, there's probably not much difference between modern education and computerized education, but neither one is any good. So we have this problem, a gorgeous situation coming along. We're going to do bigger and better things, no discipline, no control, and no idealism. Then we go into the practice of medicine. There have been great advancements of medicine since the clinics of Hippocrates. There have been wonderful values. Great physicians have arisen who have done much for mankind. Vesalius in anatomy and Paracelsus in pharmacology. All these things have been great contributions. But look at the condition of things today. The entire subject has gone mad, and everything has been gradually summed up in the terms of profit. The end of science with the ancients was to serve the need of man. The end of service today is the accumulation of wealth. So we have a problem in which lack of morality has thrown the whole thing into a complete fiasco. Now, the problems of religion are not essentially different either. Religion is becoming a combination of a divine revelation and a human nuisance. All that is essentially good we need, but it is being exploited right and left. And nobody has enough understanding in themselves to tell when they are being exploited. An individual choosing a religion should at least think about it enough to decide what is good for him. All this is a great, wonderful world, and here we, each of us, is another Alice, in this case, in Blunderland. Also, we go to another problem, entertainment. We all need to be entertained. The Greeks had a good theater, the Chinese had a good theater, the Japanese have. And most of the primitive people had either their bards or skulls who were able to dramatize stories and do all kinds of things for entertainment. But all of a sudden, what is entertainment? Just a vast economic competition, practically nothing else, existing for the prime purpose of perpetuating advertising. So we go down one thing after another. Anywhere we wish to look, we find the same essential principles. Everything in all of these areas has suddenly become so completely economized and so completely exploited. As every individual has deemed himself a proper billionaire, even if he doesn't deserve it. And the result is we have tremendous unemployment and poverty on the one hand, and reckless waste on the other. So Bacon, probably looking over these things, might say to someone that in the Bible, they did not actually give any definition for the sin that cannot be forgotten or forgiven. The unforgivable sin is marked only by the term that it is the sin against the Holy Spirit. Now, neither the Bible nor the church has been able to do very much with either of those terms. The Holy Spirit is pictured usually as a radiant dove. What it stands for is extremely uncertain, even in theology. And, of course, the unforgivable sin is referred to several times in the Gospels, but again, it is never defined as to what it really is. But looking over the present situation as it is, it looks very much as though the unforgivable sin has something to do with things we do which cannot be forgiven. We can forgive each other small problems. We can forgive each other reasonable mistakes. Jesus said, the man who's taught or teaches against Jesus can still be forgiven. But there's something that can't be forgiven, and that is the complete collapse of integrities. Now, we are in a world today where we have tremendous privileges. And Bacon, going through the story of the ancients, in a little book called The Wisdom of the Ancients, uses parables and mythological accounts taken from the past to emphasize conditions as they exist at the present time. And I think we can very definitely indicate to our content that we are all suffering from sins for which we cannot atone except by penance. Penance in this case is not the individual doing a novena or something of this kind. Penance is to recognize the mistake and try with every ounce of energy available to us to cure the condition. The problem of cure still is a long way off. And Bacon, in his summary of things, could present for us, in his term of scientific thinking, a tremendous list of changes that have to be, or something somewhere is going to be really unhappy. Bacon was fully aware of the divine fact. He was fully aware of the fact that there is a benevolent force at the source of life, and that this inevitable benevolent force cannot be destroyed. This force is stronger than the whole structure of the solar system put together. In fact, it can control the entire content of space. It is therefore inevitable, immutable, and irrefutable. And that is the law governing existence. Now, to understand the laws governing existence, we cannot be content with a scientific approach. We cannot merely take the law of gravity as a symbol of the great values of reality. It is interesting, it is valuable, and it is probably true with certain modifications. But the great laws of life are laws of integrity. You have to use it well to be rewarded. And if you use it wrong, you will be punished. And for this, there will never be a solution. All the political change in histories that could possibly come will not make wrong right. It has never been able to actually right a wrong of the past. Everything has to work from a basis of solid principles. Principles which, if violated, will bring inevitable consequences. The absolution is available to the repentant person for certain values and mistakes of living. But after he reaches a certain degree of individual intelligence, he is no longer subject to the virtues of forgiveness. He must earn his way. Earn his way not through a mild economic crisis, but a tremendous journey through space. He must go gradually until he learns to use the great instrument constructively. He has to keep the rules and find that these rules are really keeping him, and that if he violates them, there is something wrong he cannot do anything about. Now, the seat of this concept in man appears to be in the soul. Therefore, the soul, in a sense, may be the dove of the Holy Spirit. The soul is a world structure of beauty, order, integration, and peace. It arises within the individual, it is communicated to the individual, and it is distributed by the individual. But the soul is an integrity in the individual. The soul is a peace at the source of individual and collective existence. The laws of the universe all spring from peace and must return to it after they have passed through these periods of perversion and perversity. So the soul becomes a symbol of integrities. It becomes the sign of doing it right. Now, there's been quite a problem also in connection with religions. Religion has always been a more or less complex situation. We have been so busy downgrading other people's religions that we have really no thought or time for our own. In the world of religion, each believer is right, and all other believers are wrong, to some degree anyway. But in any event, religion is also mixed up in this problem of integrities. The religions of the world have all given us a Ten Commandments, or the equivalent thereof, and also special commandments like those given by Jesus to his apostles. The religions of the world are all based upon peace, upon the recognition of one divine power as Lord of all that exists. Most of the religions accept this, but do not practice it. In practicing it, they are exclusive when they should be inclusive. So religions are also in bad way. They are also breaking the rules of their kind. The rule of religion as given in every scripture of the world is love one another. And that if we have any real religion in our natures, we will forgive those who will work against us in one way or another. Now, a religious world of love at the present time does not exist. There are units of love within this religion. There are people who are trying, doing desperately, but the great pattern goes on in a form of an extreme competitive reaction towards value. And yet all these religions and their structures cannot work together. Therefore, in a day of a great emergency, when religious unity is essential to the support of something, the support is simply lacking. I remember attending an early congress on comparative religion. Now, that's a nice-sounding word, comparative religion. But what was the congress composed of? A representative from each of the Christian sects, no non-Christian, was included in comparative religion. Now, this type of thing isn't extremely obvious, but it's there. And the problems we have at the present time in the Near East are largely based on religion. All over the world, the struggle for integrities goes on. One group is trying to eliminate a religion entirely. Another is trying to restore it as the leader of human values. But up and down, in and out, and off and on, very few groups are practicing it in their own personal relationships. So here is another place where beautiful truths, beautiful ideals, are compromised for what? They are compromised because they interfere with the personal objectives of individuals. Bacon had quite a time trying to figure out what the man was made of on the inside. He could take care of the outside fairly well, but the inside was very mysterious. What is it within the individual by which he is desperately desiring of dominating some other individual? Why is it that he has to always be right when in life, time after time, he is wrong? I've taken people for consideration and study who say they have never made a mistake in their lives, and because of that came to me because they couldn't stand it any longer. They're making hundreds of mistakes, but for every one of them there was an excuse. It was always someone else to blame. The individual is very reluctant to admit any imperfection in himself. And if he does admit it, he passes over it lightly and thinks of something else. So we have another problem. What is there inside of the human being to help him to cure the problem we are in now? How are we going to face this dilemma? Here we have a world technically at war. Here we have poverty and wealth side by side as never before in history. Here we have genius and madness against each other. Vast political combines, great industrial combines, the economic system completely out of whack. Everything is out of relation and proportion. Why? Because each individual regards himself as a free and independent entity, capable of doing and entitled to do anything he pleases, regardless of its effect upon anyone else. This is perhaps one of the good definitions for a sin that cannot be forgiven. We are not doing anything with the structure of our integrities. It is fortunate, however, that in the last 25 years, the divine plan, as Lord Bacon gradually unfolded it, is taking over. We are not at all happy about it, because when it comes to being good, we are extremely reluctant. We are much more interested in our own mistakes and keeping them up. We have troubles with everything. We have the troubles with everything from cigarettes to narcotics. Everywhere, every individual has the feeling that he is perfectly entitled to destroy himself. He is perfectly entitled to do exactly what he pleases and to anyone he pleases. He is an island of isolated superiority in a universe of mediocrity. The definition applying to each of them, of course. Now, all this together comes back again to tradition. There has to be some recognition of a universal fact that should be taught to every schoolchild and every adult and every oldster in a retirement home. Namely, you cannot break the rules without suffering. You cannot live against the divine plan without destroying yourself. This is an inevitable and an immutable fact, and we cannot find one episode in history where that has ever been different. We have also seen these negative factors destroy good factors. We've seen martyrs destroyed by fools and dictatorships. But in the long run, all things fall back into the mystery of the divine purpose. Why are we here? Why are we individuals? Albertus Magnus and others of that patristic school are quite convinced that man was given a certain amount of individuality. He was capable of making certain decisions and the privilege of fulfilling them. But when this individuality tempts him to transact various objectives contrary to integrity, the privilege ends. The individual is wrong the moment he does wrong. And he is wrong the moment that what he does helps or hurts in different ways. Every way we know that the plans that fail are the ones that were not right in the first place. Now, we also realize that nearly all of the great philosophies, religions, and sciences of the world began in periods of comparative simplicity. Those involved had very small interests and lived in a very moderate environment. Great wealth was unknown to the average person in those days. They all lived very much alike, in a kind of moderate condition for their kind. Their education, their culture, their religion were all part of their natural way of life. Sophistication as we know it today was non-existent. So we find these people finally developing within themselves one of the first human institutions of law, the Code of Hammurabi. This ancient code was to take care of something of the minor delinquencies of the people of the area for which it was developed. That is what we now call the Near East. Actually, Hammurabi, some 3,000 years ago, nearly, maybe a little more. But anyway, he had some ideas. But he evidently was being forced to ideas by the emergence of negative factors in human nature. One thing he says among his code laws is that if a builder builds a house that falls down almost immediately, he must build it again and do it right. Well, this was a great innovation. We haven't had that in Los Angeles in years. We don't even know such things as that. We've outgrown it. And we have outgrown it to the degree that every time there's bad weather, we have another period of devastation. On another ground, Hammurabi went into other things. He disliked definitely the idea of alimony. He felt that was a destruction of the home and the commercialization of relationships. Of course, we wouldn't believe that at the present time, but we do notice that sometimes the allotments are pretty heavy. Also, Pythagoras, a little later, brought in the harmony of music, and music is a symbol of harmony. He says, human beings, to survive, must live harmoniously. Harmony begins in heaven and ends in the gallbladder. Harmony is not only a tremendous cosmic value, but it's the ability of the capillaries to get along together. The human body has to have harmony. It has to be taken care of. If we abuse it, it becomes sick. And when we are tired of seeing it sick, we decide that the gods are against us. All these things recognized in daily living are still not recognized on the moral level. The average person lives far below the moral level of the world status as it is today or should be today. We know much better than we do. And what we should be doing is trying to do what we know. But wherever what we know and should do interferes with what we want to do, we enter into a state of corruption. So all these things add up to one tremendous point, and that is that the mistake can never win. We will never be able to move the world into the kind of selfish situation, this aggrandized pattern which we want to indulge in. We can never live in a world in which everybody has too much. We can never live in a world where most people have nothing. All these things will not live and cannot survive, because laws of nature are concerned primarily with natural processes. They are concerned with seeing the fulfillment of the reason for these various forms of life and the forms and phases through which they pass. Nature is honest, and honesty is a tremendous virtue. And nature is honest because it has no choice. Whatever the power is of nature is irrefutable. Nature does what nature does, and by the power of the divine principle behind and within nature, nature moves in an orderly, progressive way to the fulfillment of its eternal purpose. Nature cannot be bribed, and it cannot be corrupted. But it falls into patterns in relationship to bribery and corruption. Little by little, it eats its way through all of the artificial factors that human beings have built up. So I think we can come back to the idea that perhaps, lacking a better definition, one of the sins that cannot be forgiven is the sin of personal aggrandizement and ambition, in which each individual wishes to be greater than the all. Each individual wants to be the chosen of eternity, and each individual is perfectly willing to sacrifice the rights of others to advance his own purposes. I think that this is a sin that cannot be forgiven, and it is not going to be forgotten. It is a sin which cannot be atoned for and cannot be given some slight slap on the wrist. This peculiar pattern of individual life, which places what I want above what I am in every area, is something that we're all going to have to face. We can't keep it up. We look around us. We can see, and many people do see today, the problems coming closer and closer. It is evident that the individual must use the next few years, maybe 20, 25 years, to wake up, or he's going to find himself in a very uncomfortable situation. The idea that the old prophet's head of going to hell is not very necessary. Plato says it's right here. In other words, Plato says you don't go there. You're born into it when you're born. In other words, this world is a world of instruction, of atonements, of understandings, of improvements, of dedications, and assurances of future integrities. It is a world in which we all are here to transact a kind of universal business, by means of which we will learn to be constructive, useful, honorable members of a great plan that goes throughout time and space. It doesn't mean we're going to be enslaved to something. It does not mean that we're going to be deprived of everything we want. It's going to mean that we're going to use things properly, that we're going to find the great joy of peace, the great happiness of living in a happy world, rather than one which is in constant stress and terror of the day. So out of all the ambitions and acquisitions of human thinking, behind all this terrific progeny of misfortune and bloodshed, we find this drive to world rulership, the drive towards becoming the greatest of the great, of being able to dominate others, the drive to enslave or embondage other people, or to become masters over the rest of humanity. It may only be a little family problem with who is going to run the house, or it may be a national problem, how are we going to elect a president, or a world problem, how our nations are going to get together in peace and mean it. But the fact is, as Bacon pointed out, watch, and you will see gradually the choice is restricted. There will be less choice. It won't be possible to make a dozen different mistakes. There'll be only time and energy for one. And little by little, we will observe that either these problems that we face today bring out something bigger in us, then we will have to continue to struggle with the sin that cannot be atoned. The sin of wrong purpose, wrong objectives, wrong living, wrong thinking, and a grand time had by all. This type of thing is something that we're all involved in some way or another. Now, the average person is not a great sinner. Really great sinners are comparatively rare, but small ways of misfortune and difficulties come along almost every day. One of these problems is in the relationship of what we believe to be true to what we believe we can do. Let us assume for a moment that an individual believes in God, really believes in a divine power at the source of life. Whether this is a person or a law or a principle or an energy, there's something there. That this something there has set up the moral codes of the world. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness. All these are set up as rules for the whole world. Every nation has them. Every religion emphasizes them. People claim to be religious and are very important about these things. But can they honestly say that they have never borne false witness? Are they able to say honestly that they have not avoided reasonable and proper responsibilities? Have they never tried to do a little more than they should? Have they ever at any time tried to get something they didn't deserve? Or are they going along religiously praying and playing the same old games that they've been playing for many generations? The problem is now getting very nearly critical. We don't know what to do with much of anything. And the only reason we don't know is because ambition and avarice are motivating practically every effort that we make. Therefore, there is a great sin. Perhaps the most important of all the sins has been ambition. From this fell the angels. And Job and many of the mystics telling about the fall of Lucifer, Goethe in his Faust, Milton in his Paradise Lost, all have emphasized that it was the human being who by his own selfishness and by false experiences and falsified evidence has gradually deteriorated from the principles which are necessary to his survival. So, as with the angels, if they fell from temptation, the temptation of gain, the temptation of glory, the temptation of being more important than somebody else, all this has led gradually to a built-in webwork of ulterior motives. We cannot really be sure today whom we can trust. We do not know who is fair, who is honest, who is going to fulfill a contract. We are completely rotted through with the one infinite desire for wealth and power. So we have to begin to think of this in terms of the great structure of life. Fortunately, as Buddha pointed out, we're going to have plenty of time to make the decisions. If we don't make them this time, we'll make them, because there's nothing else that can happen but ultimate surrender to truth. There can be nothing else. But it may take a while to get to it, because each individual will give up his personal privileges reluctantly, even though those privileges are killing him. He will want to die his own way. He would rather commit suicide than live honorably. All this is happening today. And it starts with a number of very interesting facts.